Flash number 17370, Gaspar Arajanyan, reel 4.
Arajanyan, reel 4.
So he went, he drove up to the palace, and the king asked him, because he was in charge of supplies, he was at headquarters. He had the rank of captain then. And he was in charge of all supplies. So the king asked him to find out how many 25-pounder shells they had in stock. He was surprised. Why did he ask him and not Ghulam Pasha, who was the chief of staff? But on his way to the office, he stopped at Ghulam Pasha's house and told him, the king wants to know how many 25-pounder shells we've got. He said, go and tell him we have 2,000. But he went to the office, he looked up to find they had, the Glob said, tell him we have 2,000. 2,000, yes, I'm sorry. And he went to the office and looked up the file, and he saw that they had 25,000. He was puzzled. What do I do now? Well, he thought, as a good soldier, he should obey his immediate superior, his immediate. He told the king that they had 2,000 shells. Next day, the news on the radio announced Jordan agreed to the ceasefire. And that was the end of the thing, because after that, the Jews started getting reinforcements, getting supplies in Jerusalem, and the situation changed completely.
So that again indicates British involvement.
Yes. Ghulam, although he was supposed to be an official, an officer in the Jordanian army, paid by the Jordanian army, it means he was something else also. And yeah, this was the position. So
it would seem the Arabs didn't have a great deal of chance, really, in the partition. Yeah. Would you?
And then when they had the second ceasefire and the armistice, the meetings for armistice discussions and so on, they had the armistice agreement with the Jews, Jordanian sent a delegation to Rhodes, that's where they had the conference, and they agreed on an armistice. Those who went there, who went to the Jordanian delegation, they didn't know anything about Palestine, about the geography of Palestine. They had no idea. And the result was, when the Jews decided, proposed the dividing the area and what the boundaries are going to be, the Jews knew what they were doing, whereas these Jordanian people had no idea. And the result was, you see, on the map, you see a village, say, this is, it's marked on the village like this. This is the, say, Tulkarim, village of Tulkarim, or the town of Tulkarim. It doesn't show that all the lands of that village are here. So the Jews said, yes, you want this Tulkarim to be on your side? All right, we'll draw the line here. So the result was the houses of the village were here, and the lands were all on the Jewish side. So these villagers were sitting there and watching the Jews cultivating their land. You know, this is what happened. Why? Because they didn't take a Palestinian expert with them who knew where the lands were. It was just a Jordanian officers who went there, and they agreed to whatever the Jews proposed. They thought they'd achieved something. And this is the result. Anyhow, I continued staying with my sister, with the family, and I was, at the beginning, I was hoping to that something would be done and Jerusalem would become internationalized and I would get a job in the courts there. But it didn't seem like it. In the meantime, I was corresponding with some friends and my old boss in Jerusalem was here. I was corresponding with them. I had ideas of coming to England because I was thinking of joining one of the inns of court, becoming a barrister here. But I wasn't encouraged very much because the situation here wasn't very good because there was a shortage of housing and so on. And one of my friends wrote and said, if you were a bachelor, I would have told you to come. But with a family, it's going to be very difficult. There's no housing and food is rationed and so on. So, we couldn't get much news about our house. Incidentally, when I left the house, I gave the keys of the house to our Jewish neighbors. And the Jewish authorities decided that something should be done because I was considered to be an absentee. And they would have been entitled to confiscate all my possessions. So they were just about to do that when my neighbor got in touch with Astrid's parents and said, if you could do something to take possession of this property. So I had a message from Astrid's father through the Red Cross. You know, they have got some special forms where he could just write a few sentences. He said, try to come over, otherwise they're going to confiscate all your possessions. So I started thinking whether I should go. Well, I can't go and I can't get in touch with them. They're enemy territory, of course. So, but I had to do some money, some work to get a little money. I was working there. I was waiting to see what was going to happen. Will I get my pension? How is it going to be paid? Fortunately, I was able to work for 5 months as legal advisor to the British Council. Their representative in Palestine was trying to liquidate their leases in Palestine, and I helped him draw up agreements and so on with the landlords. And I went with them to Beirut to see the landlords, and also we went also to Hebron. Anyhow, I worked. That was little money, which was most welcome. I don't know if you had heard about King Abdullah's Black Queen. The Black Queen, Nahda was her name. She was the daughter of African slaves of the house of Sharif of Mecca, King Hussein, who's the great grandfather of the present king. And when he had to come out of Hijaz on a British destroyer, he brought the slaves with him. he was taken to Cyprus, and some of them went to Amman. And this Nahda, with her mother, were living in Amman, but they were living in a cave just below the royal palace, near where my sister's house was. And she used to come and, her mother used to come and do my sister's washing. And they became very good friends. Eventually, this daughter became the favorite of the king.
King Hussein?
King Abdullah.
Abdullah. I see.
And he built for her a palace. She was black, African, but he built for her a white palace across the road from my sister's house. And they were very good friends, and I've been to her house several times, and used to call me Uncle Gaspar. And she saw me there in my sister's house and garden. She thought she wanted to help me without consulting me. One day she telephoned my sister. She said, I'm sending my car to take Gaspar to the king, to see the king. So I was surprised. All right, the car came. I went up. And there he had an open session with a big room full of all sorts of people. And I went to him, and he expects you to kiss his hand, which I did. And he said, you were a judge in Palestine. I said, yes. Well, this afternoon you go to the Minister of War. He was standing next to him. He will give you a job in Palestine. It's the same job. I didn't want to work. So, and he again gave me his hand to kiss, and that was the end of the... So, I went down and told my sister, please tell Nahda that I don't want the job, I don't want to work here. One reason being that I went, when I had nothing to do, I went and to the Court of Appeal and met two of the judges there. And I was surprised when we were sitting having coffee, the chief clerk came in with a pile of files. He put in the entry of one of the judges. And as we were talking, having coffee, he took a file, opened it, signed, and put it in the outre. Took the file, put in the outre, without reading, without looking. I was curious. I said, excuse me, what are these? Oh, he said, these are cases, appeal cases. And what's happening? We said, we have an arrangement. We are three judges here. We have an arrangement. Every month, one of us takes the files, reads the two appeal, statement of appeal and the statement of reply, and he gives a decision, which he passes on to us, and we just sign. I said, you don't have a open court hearing? No, what for? They have said whatever they had to say is here in writing, so that's enough. So it means it was one judge of the three who makes decisions, the others just sign. That wasn't the kind of justice that I was interested in, so I didn't want to have anything to do with it. So anyhow, then we decided to... during the last days, I had sent in my application for naturalization as a British citizen. And when I went to Amman, I wanted to notify the Home Office here that I was in Amman. And I sent my letter through the British Embassy there. Then we had a reply that Fortunately, I'd kept a copy of the application, which I sent for easy reference to them. So they wrote back and said they had not received my application, although I knew it was passed on by the Chief Justice with recommendation. And so, but they said they have decided to grant me the naturalization and sent me the form, which I had to take to the consul and take the oath and sign it, and it was done, it was arranged. Because now that I had British citizenship or British passport, we decided to go to Cyprus. From Cyprus, we could get in touch with Astrid's parents in Haifa and see if we could go from there.
So what date did you go to Cyprus, Gaspar?
It was in April 1949.
So that would have been before the Troubles, really, would it?
Oh, yes.
Before the Troubles, yes.
Before the Troubles, yes.
Yes, yes.
So we decided, yes, we went to Cyprus. And
was that to Kyrenia?
Not to Kyrenia immediately. We went to Nicosia. We had some friends there who had booked accommodation for us in a pension in Nicosia. And we stayed there. I was continuing to correspond with our friends here in England. And in the meantime, I had obtained the agreement of the Gray's Inn that they would cut the number of dinners you have to have by half for me. So instead of 3 years, it would be 18 months only. So that was all right. But again, there was the question of life in England. It was difficult. So my good friend, and he was my boss, actually, in Jerusalem, Dr. Good, who lived in Saffron Walden. He advised me against coming at that time. So we're in Cyprus. What do we do? I had to do some work. A cousin of mine was working for the Mantashev Oil Company. He said, we have a temporary job. Would you like to take it? I said, yes, anything. So I went there. As I had to draft replies to letters, £20 a month, which was not bad. So I worked there for a little while, and then I was told about this American monitoring station at Caravas. They were looking for linguists, especially Arabic. They wanted somebody to know Arabic. So I applied there, and in July 1949, I was appointed. I got a job there.
Was that mainly sort of broadcasting?
Listening to broadcasts, yes, Arabic broadcasts, and sort of summarizing what the broadcast contained, and making transcripts of, in translating into English, some of the parts, the essential parts, I mean the interesting parts of the broadcast. Speeches and things like that, and some important news items of what was happening in the country, the broadcast.
When the Troubles erupted, were you affected by the sort of emergency in Cyprus, in Kyrenia?
Well, like everybody else, I mean, there's no immediate danger for us because we are not involved. But it meant restricting our movements in the country. Then when I got the job with the Americans, at the beginning, of course, the girls were too young to go to proper school. They went to sort of a kindergarten thing run by an American lady, one of the wives of the American officials. And after that, it was in the 1955, I think, when the troubles started, which means that Edessia was 10 years old, Sophie was about 12 years old, so they were started going to the English school, the junior school in Nicosia, run by an English headmaster. And they were taken by a special bus. That, of course, there was some danger, and on one or two occasions they did see dead bodies on the way. And, yes.
Yes, I suppose the next big conflict for you was the Turkish invasion of 1964?
Well, 1964, there was the first threat by the Turks to invade. And the Americans decided to evacuate us to Kavarsham here. To Kavarsham, and we continued to work in Kavarsham. And we were there 18 months, then went back to Cyprus when the danger was over. There was another threat by the Turks in 1967.
And that, again, was invasion, was it?
Again, we threatened to invade. Again, they were stopped by the Americans. And so when the third threat was in the horizon, they were threatening again to invade. Well, everybody thought that, again, the Americans would stop them, but this time they were not stopped. And the interesting thing, at that time, of course, I was already retired. I had retired. But the interesting thing is that those who were still working, some of our friends, told us that they were asked to go up. There was a flat bit on the mountains just above Kyrenia, where the United Nations force was. They were advised to go up there. They're told not to take anything with them. They will be just for a few hours, that's all, when the fighting broke out. So one of our friends who was still working, the telephone said, you know, they have advised us to go up to Chiklos. What about you coming with us too? I said, no, why should I come? I'll stay here. These poor people went up there with no food, no warm clothing. They had children with them. And thinking that they'd be back within a matter of hours. That was on Saturday they went up. They remained there until the following Tuesday. There were some British families living in that area whom we knew very well. So we telephoned and said, what's happening? And there was some bad language about the Americans for those fools sending those poor people up here. And they tried to help them as much as they could. They gave them water, some food, and some warm blankets and things for the children. And they were caught between two fires. The Greeks were on one side and Turks were on the other side, and there was crossfire, and they were caught between the crossfire. And they remained there until Tuesday, when the Royal Navy came and rescued them, took them on to the HMS Hermes, the aircraft carrier Hermes. Even the Americans were taken by the British.
So, was there any? Did you get any feeling about the Americans' view of the 1974 invasion? You know, they managed to stop the earlier ones, but was that...
My impression I got was that they knew about it and they were encouraging, but they were thinking that the Greeks or the Greek Cypriots would surrender very quickly. They wouldn't put up any resistance, and so the whole thing will end within a matter of hours. That's it. But the Turks thought otherwise, and they kept on moving until they occupied about one third of the whole island.
What was your experience of that invasion yourself? You know, when were you first aware that they were coming?
It was 5 o'clock in the morning. I usually get up very early in the morning, so I got up. Astrid was still sleeping, so I got up. I was surprised. I could hear the explosions and aircraft flying overhead. Well, I said, this time they have done it, so they have come. So I went and told Astrid, well, get up, the Turks are coming. So we got up and we said, well, what do we do now? We said, everything we have is here in this house. We have worked all these years. So, and we said, well, after all, they are soldiers of a member of NATO, allies of Britain and America, and must be disciplined soldiers, so we'll stay here. We had a big water tank on the roof, because very shortly after the invasion started, electricity was cut off. That means that water supply would be stopped because it was pumped. So we said, we have some water, we have some food, we had candles for lighting, we had some paraffin we could use. It means our refrigerator was full because we were expecting some guests from here. We had bought a lot of meat and things like that. But it means it's going to rot. It was very hot in July, very hot weather, and it doesn't matter. So we said, we'll stay here, nothing to worry about. But that was on Saturday. And I could see the warships lined off the coast. They were bombarding. There were 12 very big transport aircraft bringing troops. There were about 60 helicopters flying. They were bringing all the soldiers. Then on, the electricity was cut off, but telephones were still working. So we were in touch with our friends. I was a life member of the United Kingdom Citizens Association. I served as deputy chairman for a number of years, so they made me a life member. I still have the membership card. So we were in touch with them. Then on Sunday, one of our friends telephoned, said, have you heard what happened at Karmi village? He said, some of the Turkish soldiers came down from St. Hilarion up on the hill. There's some old castle there. Went down to the Karmi village where there were some British families living, retired British families. They went into the house of an old couple and tied them to chairs, gave them good beatings, and held themselves to valuables in the house. Well, that, of course, meant that what we thought were disciplined soldiers were not disciplined after all. So if they will do that sort of thing to an English couple, what would they do to an Armenian couple? So we said, well, this changes the situation. We telephoned Bob McGonigal, who had a restaurant just outside Kyrenia. He was a retired major of the parachute brigade. We said, we come down there, because the arrangement was, according to the High Commission, which were being broadcast on the forces radio, that we would gather somewhere around near where this restaurant was,